As I remember, we were talking about how after Prabhupada left, there wasn't clarity about how Prabhupada's disciples would perform their duties as gurus. And what ended up happening is that they took a position which was a lot higher than their godbrothers, and basically every guru had, practically all the devotees were their disciples, other than their godbrothers, wherever they were GBCs. Yeah. So there started to be a disenfranchisement of godbrothers. But the interesting thing was that on the other side, there were godbrothers that were saying, no, this is how it's supposed to be. This is how we worship Prabhupada, and this is how you should worship them. So it actually wasn't all one-sided. You had both. Some pushing that now the center of ISKCON is divided into 11 zones, or 11 gurus, and each one will be the center of their zone, and it's kind of like 11 people replacing Prabhupada. Instead of having Prabhupada one guru, now we had 11, and then locally people would take initiation. And so that was being promoted kind of in as I said last week, with the thinking that Prabhupada had appointed these people, and with that appointment came empowerment, that they were special, that they got some shakti, some power that nobody else had. And then we should therefore exalt them above everyone else, far above everyone else, and we should support them. And they basically will take a position like Prabhupada. And so then I mentioned that it went so far that in some places some of our godbrothers were saying that you have to go through me to get to Prabhupada, and we're Prabhupada's disciples. So that was getting pretty bad. But there were devotees who were supporting that. They thought it was good. They thought that this was the right thing, that they should just do as Prabhupada did. They should be gurus as Prabhupada was guru for us. They should be guru for their disciples. And so, of course, the difference is that when Prabhupada was here, we were all his disciples. Prabhupada wasn't working with any godbrothers. None of his godbrothers were helping. But when Prabhupada left, and these gurus, they were working with godbrothers. So it created a different dynamic than we ever had before, that you have godbrothers don't see one another like disciples see the guru. And so you have the disciples honoring the guru as he should be honored, or actually more than he should be honored. And then you have godbrothers who aren't being honored at all. Some of them are even being minimized because they're not fully in agreement with what the guru is doing. So it created a lot of strain. And so one way that the strain was dealt with is that some of the gurus just let certain godbrothers know that we don't really appreciate you in the zone, so why don't you just kind of disappear or go somewhere else or not bother me or just something like that, you know, subtly or grossly. That was a message in some places. And if that wasn't the message, then what was happening was unacceptable for many, and so many just sideline themselves and just didn't participate. They didn't want to support that system, and if they didn't want to support the system and they weren't strong devotees, they didn't find any place for themselves in ISKCON. And some devotees didn't want to support it, but they did find some place for them to continue service. So in the years after Prabhupada left, up to about 1986, we had what we called the zonal acharya system, where each guru had their own zone, and they were the king of that zone. And so rather than one unified ISKCON, you really had 11 ISKCONs, each with a guru in charge, and there was a lot of competition, so cooperation also, but also competition. But the cooperation wasn't as it was when Prabhupada was here. It wasn't such a unified movement. Then you had symptoms such as if a disciple of yours became very attracted to another guru who perhaps specifically had qualities or specifically had skills or knowledge in a certain area, like perhaps it was book distribution, or perhaps it was deity worship or Varnashram, or something that that devotee's guru was not expert in, then it was natural for some disciples they'd want to learn from that guru who was expert in that particular area, or who was able to inspire them in that area, because that was the area of their service. And then in those rough days, those difficult days, then gurus would take that to be a sign of a disciple being unchaste. In other words, you're my disciple, so you hear from me, that's who instructs you, and you don't take shelter of anybody else. So that was a misunderstanding. That created further problems, because basically it got to a point where it was becoming intolerable for the God brothers. It's just they felt that Prabhupada's position was being obfuscated, which means it was being minimized to such a degree that if you joined ISKCON at that time, you may not really understand much about Prabhupada, but you would understand that here's the guru, and that's the person that you should take shelter of, and that's the person that should give you instructions. So it was not a healthy situation, and it was difficult for everybody. So it became intolerable, and even the supporters of the system started to see that there were difficulties in the system. They started to see that Prabhupada was no longer in the position that he was before he left. It seemed that he was in many ways being replaced. Replace is probably not a good word, but just being, we would normally say, taken out of the center. In some way, not given the importance that he should have been given, and then the importance was being transferred to those gurus. And so it was creating problems, because ISKCON was not Prabhupada centered. And so even the people that initially supported the system saw that it wasn't working. And so many of them no longer supported it. But the problem that we had was devotees were saying, but the guru should be worshipped as a representative of God, and Prabhupada showed us the example of his guru, so therefore that's how the worship should go on. And in the eyes of the disciple, the guru is absolute. The guru can do no wrong. So that was the basic assumption. But it was really difficult to deal with a guru in any other way, because that was what our Shastra told us. The guru is absolute. You should always see the guru as perfect. He perfectly represents Krishna. And we basically said, you know, understood it. Well, whatever your guru says, you just do that, accept that as correct. That was basic understanding that we were going on. But then some of the gurus had some difficulty in maintaining their Krishna consciousness. Now, one of the reasons they may have had difficulty, most likely had difficulty, is that they were kind of imitating Prabhupada's position, or kind of taking the position of a more advanced position than they actually had. And they were also, as I said, because they were the most powerful person in the zone, so they had more power than most of them could handle, because it required a tremendous amount of humility to be able to handle that power and still be humble. And so it was affecting some of them, and some of them were becoming a little proud, some offensive, some perhaps overconfident, and some just contaminated by the position and the honor, you know, thinking, I'm so great, I'm so wonderful. And we started to see gurus falling down to such things as drugs and illicit sex, which are things which we could never imagine would have happened to these people. But started happening, and it didn't just happen to one of them. Eventually, it happened to 8 of them out of the 11. That 8 of them had trouble, and 8 of them gave up their service. So that was sending shockwaves through ISKCON, and it was creating a lot of doubt in the gurus that were present. You know, let's say, one guru, I forget when the first fall downs were. I know one was in 1981 or 1982. There was one 1981 because I had to deal with it. 1986, I know, but there were ones before that, maybe 1979. Anyway, you know, one of them fell, another one of them fell. You know, that was okay. But over the years, 8 of them fell. So as they fell, devotees were even losing faith in the gurus who weren't falling. Because the other ones were falling, they were thinking, well, if they're falling, that means maybe my guru is not as exalted as I thought he was. And so there were all these questions about, well, is he actually perfect? Is he absolute? Is he just, you know, because the Shastra says he's not ordinary. You should not see any contamination in your guru. And then all of a sudden, these gurus are falling down. So and a lot of devotees left because they lost faith in the whole process. They had given their life to these gurus, and then the gurus themselves didn't follow what they instructed their disciples to follow. So it was a very difficult time. And as I said before, a lot of the godbrothers understood, well, they were taking a position above their godbrothers. They were taking worship every day. They were basically taking a position like Prabhupada, and that was not their position. They're not on that level, and they shouldn't have taken that position. And the result is that they were starting to fall down. So this actually hit a climax. I don't know if you know this, all this history, because this is, you know, this is 30 years ago. But what happened at that time, there was what was called a guru reform movement, or something of that nature. And devotees were trying to reform the system. So they worked together along with the GBC to discuss this whole guru thing and try to adjust it to a better system, because this system was just, everybody realized that these people are not like Prabhupada, and we can't keep them on that level. Now, during this time, there was practically, I don't want to say there was a revolution, but there was a meeting with many of the GBC, and it was open to anyone. So many godbrothers came and I attended the meeting. And this happened in 1976. And the godbrothers spoke what was on their mind and spoke their frustrations about the system. And at that point, it became apparent to the gurus in the GBC that were there that the way things have been going is going to have to stop. Now, you're asking, Well, how were things going? Well, let's take it to where it perhaps was the worst, or the worst I saw it. The bathroom of the guru basically looked like the temple room, if you could imagine a bathroom like that. Chandeliers in a bathroom, gold-plated knobs, extravagant marble, like that. And if that gives you an idea, I don't know, does that give you an idea?
Yes.
You get some sense of just, you know, the idea is that we would do, you know, we would do everything we could to please Prabhupada and treat him on this exalted level. So that was happening for many of the gurus, and to one degree or another, So you go into their quarters, and I'd be, you know, $10,000, $15,000 worth of furniture, you know, fine European furniture, and several rooms, offices, meeting rooms, elaborate, you know, extravagant bedrooms. And it was just, you know, he was the guru. So, and, you know, he's got hundreds and hundreds, thousands of disciples in his zone. It's all his people. So naturally they want to serve their guru. You know, so the best of the best of the best. And very surrendered, doing whatever he would say. So it hit a point in 1986 where many of the Godbrothers met in New Vrindavan to express their feelings and their frustrations, and also to express what they felt was wrong with the system. And then, that I forget what time, if that were the was the summer or not, but that year, 1986, when this meeting happened, two of the most powerful gurus in ISKCON were exposed to, one, it was found out that he got one of his god sisters pregnant, and another one felt incapable of continuing in that position, so he just resigned and left ISKCON and got married. He was a sannyasi. These are two of the, I mean, the top four biggest leaders in the movement. And so that was just kind of like the icing on the cake, which was saying, okay, if they've fallen, then this is not working. Something has to change. So from that point, 1986 and onwards, the system started changing. And I don't know the dates, but just to give you some perspective on what was happening, as I said last class, that after Prabhupada left, then the gurus were being honored in a similar way in which Prabhupada was honored. So they had Vyasa-sans about an inch shorter than Prabhupada's. So, you know, Prabhupada's Vyasa-san is, you know, Prabhupada was sitting about chest high. You can't see my chest. But Prabhupada's Vyasa-san is about chest high. So theirs was just a little lower. And that was the seat of the Acharya. So every zone had an Acharya, one person. That was his seat. Right? Basically, he would give all the Bhagavatam classes, or 95%. So, you know, used to be everyone would give class, and so when he was present, he was the one giving the classes. So it's basically his show. And then every day, there would be Guru Puja for him, like we do for Prabhupada. There would be Guru Puja for him. And, you know, and he'd have his, I don't know, every temple may have been different, but, you know, might have some super nice car that's just for him, and his drivers, and his servants, and his cooks, and his this and that. And as I said last time, this was something that never happened before. So, I mean, you know, have somebody cook for you, this and have a servant, it's not a big thing, but it was extravagant in many cases. So after 1986, then, well, I'll tell you another story. It was quite interesting. That, as I was saying, while this was going on and being supported in ISKCON as the standard for guru worship, there were even some gurus who didn't buy into it, didn't want to do it, who didn't want to sit on big asasanas. And they didn't want to sit on big asanas. And they didn't want to have all the trappings of a big guru on Prabhupada's level. They just wanted to serve. That's, you know, they didn't want a position. They didn't, you know, feel the need for these things. They just wanted to do service and, you know, guide disciples. So I don't know the year. It probably was around 1980. No, it couldn't have been 82 because I wasn't in America. Maybe it was a little earlier. Maybe 1980. I was in the meeting. So there may be five GBC men. And the local GBC in Los Angeles had decided that the tradition that we had of having this big seat, just an inch or two shorter than Prabhupada's, was not proper. And that the guru should not have a seat. There should just be a seat for the Bhagavatam speaker. Because that was the tradition that we had found out about later in Gaudiya Math, that everyone just sits, actually in Gaudiya Math, they just sit on a cushion on the floor. And they don't have guru puja for the local gurus. So this one guru decided to take out his seat and not have it. And he got in trouble for that from the GBC and said, no, you can't do that because the guru has to be worshipped in this way, as we're doing now, on the big seat and so forth. And if you do this, it disrupts the whole system. So they wouldn't let him do it. So it gives you an idea of how strong, how into it, or how much the GBC felt that the way they were doing, establishing the position of guru, the way they felt, that's how it should be, how strong that was, their feelings towards that. But at the same time, you had all these dissenters who were saying, no, it's not the way it's supposed to be. So then we go back to 1986, and then these two big gurus fall. And they were probably, at that point, number four and five. They were like one, two. They were number three and four, or four and five, or five and six by then. So it's not looking good, right? So then the guru reform movement starts, and the GBC starts having meetings, and everybody realizes this whole idea of one guru, one zone, this doesn't work. And there had been some pushing to make more gurus, but they were very, very cautious about it. And the feeling was they didn't want to give up their power, or they didn't, for some reason, feel like it was going to work if we have too many gurus. Because of the system they set up, if someone else becomes guru in my zone, how's that going to work? So they were very reluctant to allow anyone else to be guru. So they had appointed a few, but it was within the hands of the GBC to appoint. It wasn't that you could just become a guru on your own. And they were very reluctant to appoint. So not many people up to this point had become guru. So with the guru reform, part of the idea was we need to make more gurus. And we need to reform how a guru is worshipped and honored. So this was kind of treading some kind of dangerous path, because how can you minimize the position of guru? Because the Shastra never minimizes its position. But at the same time, we understood that we are not on the level of Prabhupada, so then how can we be worshipped on the level of Prabhupada? So there were some confusing issues. And then what about all the other God brothers? What's their position? If they don't want to initiate, but they're preachers and they have people that follow them, how do they fit into this whole thing? And then also, how can we bring Prabhupada back into the center of this? Because the gurus had in some way gotten in front of Prabhupada, blocked him inadvertently, not purposely. Not purposefully or purposely. So the Guru Reform Movement started, and Vyasasanas were thrown out, Guru Pujas were stopped, chanting, oh yeah, they used to chant in every temple of that Acharya, you would chant Jai Prabhupada, and then you would chant Jai whoever that Guru was, even if you were not his disciple, just for the benefit of his disciples, you would chant his name. So then that was stopped. No, you can't chant the name of any local guru. And then gurus used to have guru names, like specific guru names, like Guru Pad, Vishnu Pad, this Pad and that Pad. I can't remember all the names. And so then GBC said, no names. Of course, you call your guru, Guru Dev, Guru Maharaj. Oh yeah, Acharya Dev, Acharya Pad. They said, no more names. Because they wanted to keep Prabhupada in the center, and they wanted to show that the gurus that came after Prabhupada, his disciples, they were gurus in every sense of the term, but there are many, many, many of them serving Prabhupada within ISKCON, and they're not the one guru, because guru means teacher. So Prabhupada's the one guru, and we're also guru, but we're just regular guru. We're not the founder Acharya. So we're regular guru. So it was the beginning of a process of making a distinction between Prabhupada and regular gurus, and what is a regular guru, and if a disciple wants to worship his guru, what does that mean? He's just a regular guru, not just, but he's a regular guru, and Prabhupada is the founder Acharya. So these were beginnings of discussions and reformation, bringing the guru down to a level in which it was normal for them. We weren't worshiping them any longer as Mahabhagwats. And then around that same time, there was discussion coming out more than ever in ISKCON about the Siksha Guru. Who's the, you know, what's the Siksha Guru? And can I have a Siksha Guru? And should I have a Siksha Guru? Is it good to have one? And how do I know who's my Siksha Guru, and what's the difference between him and my Diksha Guru? So this started coming up in the early 90s. Now, things get interesting here. Around, I think, 1986, maybe, there were devotees looking at this situation, and it was quite a mess. It was really a mess, because as I said, when a big guru leaves, so many of his disciples also left, and they lost faith. Some zones basically just collapsed. That was like the fall of the Roman Empire. Some zones were like empires. In fact, one of them was in Rome. One of the biggest preaching in the world was going on in Italy. And after that guru left, because he had gotten one of his god sisters pregnant, that looks like the temple kind of looked like the Roman ruins. It's like people just lost faith. A lot of god brothers left, a lot of disciples left, and it was disastrous. So we have some breaking news here from Krishna Kirtan. Okay, is this the order? Jaya Tirtha Hansa Duda, Kirtanananda. No, Bhavananda was before. Bhagavan Rameshwar. Were the first six ones. So we're talking, and then Harikesh was in the early 90s. The Bhagavan and Rameshwar were 1986. Hansaduta Jayatirtha were probably 1982. I don't know about Kirtanananda. So there was a lot of people disrupted by this. And so around 1986, I think, around 1986. 85, 84, 86. There was a group of devotees, and I think perhaps different groups getting together with slightly different angles of vision. And they were looking at this scene, and they were saying that of 11, you know, by now six had already fallen. So, you know, many people were thinking, well, six down, five to go, you know. And why were they thinking that? Because they were thinking, these people are not qualified to do this. They're not qualified to be guru. And based on this premise, they said, look at what it's done to the movement. Prabhupada's out of the center. You've got all these disciples whose guru has fallen down. Many of them have left Krishna consciousness. The ones who've stayed, many of them have lost faith. They're no longer enthusiastic. They're having difficulties. So they began putting two and two together. Of course, they came up with five, unfortunately. And they began thinking that Prabhupada could not have appointed or directed these people to become gurus because they're not qualified. He, initially, Prabhupada had made these 11 Ritviks, which Ritvik just means a priest who was acting on behalf of Prabhupada. So they would chant on the beads and they would pick the name and they would do the fire sacrifice, arrange a fire sacrifice and be present. And so they were doing everything that Prabhupada would normally do, except they were not initiating those disciples. They were doing the ceremony. They would give the talk, they would chant on the beads, they would pick the name, they would do everything. But they were not their disciples. They were initiating on behalf of Prabhupada. So it's called a ritvik. Ritvik just means a priest who does the pujas or the samskaras on someone's behalf. So these devotees began discussing and thinking, how could Prabhupada have made these people gurus? Because they're all falling down. They're just, they're our God brothers. We all have faults, we're not perfect. And so, in our estimation, 1998, Harikesh, yeah. In our estimation, we're looking at the situation as God brothers, and we're thinking, or these people were thinking, that these people are not qualified. They're not able to do this. They're becoming proud. They're not any different than any of us. Why should we give them an exalted position? So it must mean that Prabhupada only asked them to be Ritviks, because they're not qualified to be gurus, as we can see, and that he never intended them to initiate their own disciples. He only intended that they would continue initiating disciples for Prabhupada, even after Prabhupada left. And that is called Ritvik. And there's still a contingent of devotees who subscribe to this philosophy, and they have they're different points. But the interesting thing about this is nobody had presented this idea until the mid-80s. And my theory is, if none of these gurus fell down, this idea never would have manifested. But when it did manifest, they were trying to support it with statements from Prabhupada that really had nothing to do with supporting this idea, but they were trying to interpret things that way and extrapolate and interpolate and eschew meanings from Prabhupada's statements that Prabhupada did not intend. And so now the troubled ISKCON has a contingent that's saying none of the gurus are qualified and all your initiations are bogus. And some devotees subscribe to that, and in their subscription they join another movement, Akshayapatra, the Ritviks do it, but the ISKCON does it also. It's a food distribution program. So now you had some devotees who just left ISKCON and said, ISKCON is off track. Prabhupada intended a system where we would initiate on his behalf and no one would become guru. Some people said maybe when a Mahabhagavat comes later, they can do it until then. No, they had different nuances to it, but that was a general idea. So interesting that that philosophy never came up. It took about 7 years before, or 8 years before, people started talking about it. And it's, I believe, as a response to the falling down. And so people, you know, when you study Prabhupada's teachings or books, when you start with a premise and then you try to support that premise with evidence, you'll twist the evidence to make sense for you. So that's what they did. They put this thing all together and they thought, these people are not qualified to initiate, so how is it that they can do this? Prabhupada must have never intended them to initiate. So this movement was born, and it gained a lot of steam with some very senior people, and they became very adamant that the GBC has sidetracked the movement, hijacked it, taken it off the path. This is not, Prabhupada never wanted any of us to be guru. So they're very against the GBC and very against anyone who became guru. And they call them, if you go to their website, of course they're different groups, but they call them things like guru hoaxers, fake gurus, demons, etc. And so they made a lot of very unsavory propaganda, which is not in any way complementing their efforts, because it means that much of the way they convince people that what they're saying is true is by criticizing others. And if you have to convince somebody that you're right by criticizing others, that's a very obvious sign that you have nothing better to say to support yourself, to support your position. You're standing on shaky ground, and so you try to support your position by criticizing others. And so, unfortunately, most Ritviks are doing that. Anyway, so the Ritvik idea had some good principles. Keep Prabhupada in the center. That was, you're all reading the books of your gurus, but you're not even reading Prabhupada's books. So keep Prabhupada in the center, read his books, listen to his lectures, get back to basics. So they had a lot of good things, not that it was all bad, but they didn't believe in initiation. So that movement still exists today. Now, you had another thing going on, which was quite interesting, because the Ritviks are basically saying, nobody's guru. You know, you can be a six-year guru, but, you know, keep it small. Nobody's really a guru. Then you had another phenomenon. One of Prabhupada's friends from Mathura, Vrindavan, who actually performed Prabhupada's sannyas ceremony, one of his friends was a disciple of Keshava Maharaj, and Keshava Maharaj gave Prabhupada sannyas. Keshava Maharaj was Prabhupada's godbrother and a very exalted devotee, a very special devotee. And he had disciple, and his disciple's name was Narayan Maharaj. So Narayana Maharshi did Prabhupada's sannyas, and he was very helpful, and when Prabhupada needed help, he would send things from India, and he was always a well-wisher of Prabhupada. So, I don't know when it started, maybe the late 80s, very early 90s, some senior devotees started visiting him and asking him questions about Raghunuga Bhakti and some other esoteric topics that were difficult to understand. And Narayana Maharshi, being a sannyasi at that point for 50 years or so, was very learned, and they were finding that he could answer their questions and guide them. So they started going, and then more started going, and then more started going, and then more started going. And a lot of what he was teaching was his own realization, his own style, or we could say his emphasis was different than Prabhupada's. The level of the discussions he was having was different, was more esoteric, you could say, or more geared towards a more sophisticated audience, an audience of more advanced devotees. Anyway, so more and more people were going and finding inspiration within him. And some devotees didn't like this because these leading devotees in their classes and discussions were representing a lot of what Narayana Maharshi was saying. So some people felt like, well, this is not good for the movement because we have Prabhupada's our founder acharya, so we have to focus on Prabhupada. And if you allow Narayana Maharshi to come to ISKCON and preach in ISKCON and devotees to go see him, he'll have influence. Right? He'll start to influence because he's a senior devotee. And so people started fearing that he would kind of become the guru of ISKCON just because of his seniority and his knowledge and his power. And some of the things that he was teaching, as I was saying, emphasized things that Prabhupada didn't emphasize. Not that what he was saying was wrong, but it was just the emphasis. More about rasa than about tattva. And there may have been some things that were somewhat controversial. Anyway, 1992, there was a huge opposition in the GBC, and they passed a resolution that nobody should go see him anymore, and that if he ever comes to the temple, he'll not be allowed to give any classes. So it was heavy. Basically, they were feeling that if this doesn't stop, then the influence of Narayana Maharshi will overtake the power of the GBC, and or he'll want to in some way influence them. So it was very heavy. And the devotees that were going to Narayana Maharshi on a regular basis were reprimanded. I don't know if they were sanctioned, what happened, but they were told you can no longer go there. You should have nothing to do with him. Now, it's kind of interesting, right? It's like the Mahabharata. It wasn't over then. There are many devotees who are not managers, who didn't have any position in ISKCON, who liked very much Narayana Maharshi and were taking shelter of him as their siksha guru. And because of that, their movement was growing bigger and bigger and bigger, and they started opening more temples in different parts of the world and becoming more and more powerful and learning things from him that Prabhupada didn't teach us, he didn't teach us in that way, becoming very knowledgeable and feeling like ISKCON could really benefit from what they're learning because they were feeling they were getting clarification that they needed, and Narayana Maharshi was giving it, something like that. So with the help of these Western devotees that were being attracted to him, who had gone to him and had mostly all ISKCON devotees. If they weren't ISKCON, it means they joined in his organization. But everyone else was ISKCON. So now he's getting a lot of followers, and around him a movement grows and eventually becomes quite successful. And then we're hearing things from them, such as, you should hear from Narayan Raj, he's a pure devotee. Which kind of means like, well, there aren't any pure devotees in ISKCON, so here's the one to hear from. Or he's the most pure. And, you know, hearing things of this nature, that basically we should take shelter of him. So, it created a problem. And so, what the people of Narayan Raj were stressing was they were stressing the guru, the presence of the guru, the pure devotee. And what the Ritviks were stressing is Prabhupada's the guru. They weren't stressing anybody else. Whereas Narayan Raj was like, you know, it came to the point where people were saying, his followers were saying, you know, he knows what to do, so you should just follow him. So if everybody follows him, basically he becomes the leader of ISKCON. So inadvertently, that's what they were saying. So there was a move to separate ISKCON from the followers of Narayan Raj through passing resolutions and asking people not to go there and associate with him. So a fair amount of devotees joined him and joined his movement and helped him. And so you had a lot of either exodus from ISKCON, or just people who were on the outside and not part of ISKCON joining him. As we got into the 90s and the guru reform, then we were trying to, as you can see, I'm tired, right? If it wasn't for you guys, I'd be sleeping now. It's all your fault. So, you know, as ISKCON was sorting or trying to sort out these problems, their own problems, and then the Ritviks, and then Narayan Raj, and their other groups also, as ISKCON was trying to sort out their problems, they were we're trying to figure out this something confusing that, you know, in our shastra it says the guru is absolute. Whatever he says is true, it's perfect, he doesn't make mistakes, etc., etc. So, trying to balance that with the relative realities that we have to deal with in ISKCON, such as you have a temple president who is your authority. You have a GBC who is your authority. Not only that, the GBC body make decisions that affect the entire society. And so what's the relative position between the guru and all the management? Is the guru higher? Is he on the same level? Is he lower? So that became another issue of contemplation, discussion. And today, whenever there's a guru problem, it's usually because of this. This has not been well understood, or it hasn't been well adjusted. So we're left with this question, how, if the guru is absolute, or the disciple should see the guru is absolute, then wouldn't that mean that he's above the GBC and I wouldn't have to follow the GBC? Wouldn't that mean he's above my temple president and I don't have to follow my temple president? We're going to answer that question next week. But that's the question that has been going on and still going on. How to adjust that? Because if you adjust too much, then your guru becomes like everybody else. And if you don't adjust enough, then he's given a much more exalted position than he qualifies for. And recently the GBC came out with a paper called Parallel Lines of Authority to try to establish the position, the role of the guru as absolute, and then the managerial considerations. So you're part of an organization and it has many gurus and many authorities. So we're going to talk about that. What's today? Saturday. We'll talk about that on Tuesday. What is the level of importance of the level of the guru in order to achieve perfection? Does he have to be with Tamadakari? I may have mentioned last week or the week before that question came up in a conversation. This is a fictitious story written by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And the disciple asked a question about qualifications of guru. And then the guru says, finding a guru is not a problem. He said, being a good disciple, that's a problem. Or finding a good disciple, being a good disciple, that's a problem. So first thing is I would say, Senyor, is try to be a perfect disciple. That's the most important. And you have different gurus on different levels. And you will get the association of many gurus. And if one guru is insufficient in some area, you have many other gurus you can go to. And Madhyamadhikari can do the job of guru quite well. And we're all backed by an Uttamadhikari. Whether you're the Uttama, your guru's the Uttama, or he's connected to the Uttama, there's not a whole, essentially, fundamentally, there's not a lot of difference. I mean, there shouldn't be a lot of difference. Because your guru is showing you the way from the his guru. So, it's in a sense kind of a oneness. Okay, I'm going to stop.